Welcome to From the Library with Love, a podcast for anyone whose life has been changed by reading. Rounding up randy runaway sheep and delivering twin lambs whilst making gravy. Welcome to the multitasking world of the Devon Shepherdess. Paula Steer is one of a new breed of shepherdesses blazing a trail across social media. Paula's been farming sheep at Twig Farm in Devon for the past 20 years, following in the footsteps of her great-great-grandmother, Lily Warne. Despite battling a brain tumour, this irrepressible female sheep farmer is also writing her memoirs. I started by asking her how she made the leap from accountancy to sheep.
So what happened was then I came to a turning point in my life, and I decided then I didn't want to do accountancy anymore, but I've always had this... I love sheep, everything about sheep, and, you know, not knowing really all that had happened in our previous family.
Okay.
And so I went and got my own flock of sheep, and then as the boys grew up, we had a small holding, you would call it then.
Right.
And so I had some Dorset sheep, which were prolifically a meat sheep. Okay. So I went and learnt to shepherd with a friend of mine. So I, you know, did a few years of that, who she thought I was completely barmy. Why would I go from a career to into doing, you know, sheep work? But there was just something inside me that loved it so much.
What a swerve from accountancy to...
Yeah.
And how long did it take you to learn to be a sheep?
I don't know, it's more about... I'm quite a methodical person, you know, most probably like you, so you sort of like, you pick things up a lot quicker. But I was, again, a small person dealing with big sheep, but... I would say about 18 months.
Okay. And did you feel as soon as you started it and you were working with these animals
that it was something weird?
Home, that it was the right call.
Oh, yeah.
That you just knew that sometimes we walk the paths we're supposed to walk and we don't consciously think why we're doing it. We're just, but it's an instinct, isn't it? It's from here, from our kids that we do it. And that sounds to me like what you were doing.
And then Lewis used to help me. Lewis absolutely loved it. He was exactly the same as me.
Mm-hmm.
And Benjamin hated it. But so then what happened was, you know, busy life, children, school, etc. When Lewis was 16, he did exceptionally well at his GCSEs.
Okay.
And so we said to him, if you get 12 A's, we'll buy you a quad bike. And I was like, well, there's no way we can afford to buy him a quad bike. And Keith said, well, he's not going to get 12 A's. But he got 11 A's and one B.
So
the choice was either you can have a wheel for your quad bike or have something else. And he said, well, I've always loved the sheep. I'd liked my own flock of sheep. He said, but so we said, well, choose what sheep you want and we'll buy you 3 breeding ewes. So it was the grey-faced Dartmoor sheep that Lewis chose, the ones that look like the teddy bears. So we started off with 3 ewes, which were, they were called Primrose, Beryl and Mabel.
Oh,
so we had the 3 ewes.
So
you can imagine they increased, you know, each year it increased.
Yeah.
Lewis then did his A-levels and then he went off to the Royal Agricultural University. So the flock was increasing. And one day my grandmother came to visit here.
Yeah.
And my grandmother is Lily's granddaughter, okay?
Yes, okay. I'm with you, yeah.
So she came to visit and we were lambing and Lewis said, oh, Nan, come up and have a look at the barn at these little lambs. They're the cutest lambs ever. Fluffy, you know, with a black nose. So she walked up to the barn and it was one of those things that, you know, again, you had goose pimples. So I went up with her and she leaned over, looked at this lamb. She said, oh my word. She said, your Granny Warne used to have the same breed of sheep when she was over at Bellevue.
No. So inadvertently, you were carrying on a family tradition without quite realizing it because you would call that fate really, wouldn't you?
Yeah.
So it went was it about Dartmoor grey-faced sheep that you and Lewis...
They're just the cutest sheep. They look very like me. They've got the same sort of... when we go to shows and they see them, they say, you do look... You know, you say you look like your dog. You look like
a
sheep.
You're like a sheep.
And I'm short and... what is it Lewis says? Close to the ground. I'm short and squat or something like that. And I've got a good behind, so everything a breeding sheep would be.
Are you just calling yourself a breeding sheep, that you look like a I love that.
And then it was when my grandmother up at the barn said, well, your granny used to then spin her own wool and make the posties mitts, and then to explain the situation and what went on the moors.
And was that like an epiphany for you in some way?
Yeah.
It must have been.
So Lewis was like, oh my gosh, how interesting that she did something with the wool, et cetera, et cetera. So Lewis went back to uni, and then we found out that my grandmother then had terminal cancer, and she was given a period of time to live, which was, I think it was about 12, 15 months. And so Lewis said, wouldn't it be nice if we could do something on the wool side, which would be nice really with Nan.
Yeah.
You know, to give her something to focus on as well.
Yeah.
So that's what we did. We took our first load of wool down to Launceston, which is the nearest mill to us, and we had our first lot of wool processed down there into yarn.
Okay.
And then my Nan and I would make small brooches. She, you know, just basically passing the time of day. And she'd be telling me all these stories,
And
when she was a little girl, and oh my God, you would love it, because when she lived at Moreton Hampstead, they lived in a tiny little place, and her father was very, very strict. And I mean, I can say it to you now because you know what it's like, but outside Moreton Hampstead in the Second World War, there was a place called Marden Down, and it was there they put all the black GIs.
Oh, right.
So they were all up there.
Yeah, because they weren't they, for the white GIs?
Yeah. How awful. But my Nan used to say that her and her friend Betty, me and Betty Reeman, she said, she used to come and call for me. I used to jump out, get out the window, go down the drain pipe. walk up to Marden. She said, cool, bugger me, mate. She said, they had terrific dances up there, terrific. And they had cigarettes with... They had proper cigarettes with filters, they had chewing gum, and they had proper nylons.
Oh, my God. Oh.
And then her father caught her that, and she came home and he was waiting for her, and he realised what he'd done, and he took a belt to her. I said, did that stop you, Nan? And she's like, oh, no. She said, give it a day or two. Betty come around, threw stones at the window. I was gone like a long dog. She's got
I love the sound of this.
And the other one,
you're a young one, and you see all these handsome black GIs. Of course, a moth to a flame, wouldn't it?
You can imagine it. So the story of it would make people laugh so much. And then there was another one where she said, up just outside Moreton Hampstead's little way out, there's a place called Bovey Castle. Okay. Well, it's never Bovey Castle to local people. It's always a manor house hotel. Peter de Savary bought it and changed it to Bovey Castle. But in the war, it used to be a convalescent home. For wartime. Now, I took my gran out there. It's very posh now, but I took my gran out there for afternoon tea when she was really poorly at Christmas time. And she went and found the manager, and she had a go at him because it never said anywhere in there that in the wartime that it was this hospital.
Really? And that's such a big part of the story.
So bad. But I said to her, she used to have to go out there. This is my Nan. She said, I used to have to go out there, and because she was, she's real proper Devon, and her sister had to go to elocution lessons because her parents didn't want her to be proper Devon. And she had really lovely writing. So she had to go and write for all the people who couldn't write the letters. She used to have to write the letters home to their loved ones. And I'm like, oh, Nan, that's such a lovely thing to do. She said, no, it wasn't. Have you seen the size of that bloody hill I used to have to walk up? Sweat, she said, wasn't the word by the time I got there. She said, worst thing I ever did in my life. the way that, you know, they perceive it, but we think, oh, what a lovely thing.
Yeah, she was a character then, wasn't she?
Yeah.
And remind me of her name. What was her name again, your Nan?
Kathleen.
Kathleen, okay.
Okay, so then what happened was is then she passed away, and then we started doing more and more with the business. You know, and, you know, life goes on. Then I started guest speaking, telling the story, basically, of what I'm telling you now in more depth, I suppose, and then saying about, you know, like our, you know, about the sheep and about people like with Primrose, because she was quite a game bird, let's say Primrose, one of our ewes.
Yeah.
So you just go to talk to people, and just to make people laugh and enjoy it, really. And then,
because you like sharing your family history, don't you? I can see, yeah. I can see the passion that you've got for these women. That,
and I think as well, Kate, you know, there's a lot of women out there who, even still now, do suffer from some men's torment, whether not physical, but maybe, you know, a mental side of things. I don't know. I still think we are a little bit like that, especially maybe in the rural sector.
100%. I think you're, sadly, you know, I don't know how many, the statistic, I think it's like 2 women a week are still killed at the hands of a violent man. This situation has not changed. Are we talking about domestic violence and control? Because this situation is unchanged throughout history. Mm. And it's devastating because, you know, yes, we do have more women's refugees, but the men still have a control over women as much as they ever did. And in fact, that problem is now intensified. And I think, you know, I think of your great-great-grand, and I just think, you know, she was trapped, essentially, wasn't she? So it was a very brave thing that her own daughter did to rescue her, because women were subjugated by men and still are, unfortunately. Mm. But she... I mean, what when you think about the women in your family, do you get this strong sense of the lineage coming down and the fact that you are on the shoulders of giants, really? I mean, not giants, but little women, but big stature. You know,
I think so Lily had the 3 daughters. Mm-hmm. So I knew my Granny Warren for the sweetest, lovely lady that ever was. And she taught me how to cross stitch.
Oh, how incredible.
I know, so sweet.
What you're doing now with your business is a labour of love, and it's a testament to the women, in a sense, is it?
Yeah.
So what you set up with your home is really continuing a centuries-old tradition, I suppose.
Yeah, and that's the other thing. I don't think enough people now, I mean, I've got boys, 2 boys, but I don't think enough people actually teach their children to knit, to crochet, to sew. No, I think it's quite sad, really, isn't it?
It's a lost art in many, many ways. And I think you're absolutely right. And I see this. I see the women in the East End that I go out and interview, and because obviously the East End was the heartland of the schmutter trade, and women are very good in thread. And that was something that got passed down, and now it seems to have abruptly stopped. You don't meet many people now. Having said that, actually, and I'm laughing because hopefully the woman that's going to transcribe this video for me is a lovely lady. She's a friend of mine called Sarah. She does a lot. She's resurrecting all that. She does these incredible sewing and knitting workshops, and she's encouraging a whole new generation of women to learn sewing and to learn how to old clothing and about, you know, revamping old clothing and just having those traditional skills. So there are people out there doing it, but I guess because fashion has become so disposable and fast, and we're used to going to Primark and getting stuff from Chinese sweatshops, a sense of urgency about having to fix things. You know, we're a disposable nation.
And cooking and sewing and doing everything. So Lily's daughter, Elsie, which was my great-grandmother, she was really hard. She was a real hard lady. Yeah. But then she had travesty. Her husband died. She was left with 2 children. She then had to go and marry someone just for marriage sake, to someone to look after her. Well, we don't do that anymore, do we? We're strong women. We can, have children on our own.
Yeah.
You know.
What do you think you've inherited then, Paula, from these women, from Granny Warren and Kathleen and Lily and all these? What do you personally feel that you see?
I'm not one to get depressed, really. Everyone gets low and gets down, you know. You wake up the following day and actually appreciate what you've got and what you're given with it. And I don't think sometimes there's always someone worse off.
Yeah, true.
Always someone more worse off in life.
True.
Always will. And I think when I look back, we're fortunate. So Lewis has gone on and taken on another side of, made his own business, which has become very, very good, very busy, very good.
It's called, it's the Dartmoor.
Dartmoor
Shepherd, yeah. So he's business, and you're like a subsidiary of that. You're like, so Lily Warren is.
Well, it's just like us, like mine was more family side. His is more to do with the sheep, and because the sheep were endangered, he's bought them out of the endangered side. He deals with, but he, ironically, is in Chagford, and he has grey-faced Dartmoor, white-faced Dartmoor, Devon and Cornwall Longwool, with his partner Flora. Now, Flora, again, a woman in agriculture,
yes,
she struggles with it. There's still this stigma.
Is there?
In agriculture, yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
Why? Because what, women aren't strong enough to do it? Women shouldn't be in this?
I think it's just, it's always portrayed as a man's job.
Yeah.
Whereas, like, my husband says to me, he said, but women are so much more precise, i.e., you know, writing everything down, the bookwork side of things, methodical. I think women are methodical more than men.
Yeah, yeah. I think actually, why do, or you tell me, why is raising sheep and being a shepherd or shepherdess and farming sheep, why do women lend themselves so well to that? Because obviously, what's the connection between women and these animals?
Now, I'll tell you a little story about that. When Flora started going out with Lewis,
yeah,
and she came home, so she had no sheep. She comes from a Chagford family, but no sheep orientation at all whatsoever. So we were lambing, yeah, but Lewis was home from uni with Flora, so he was up in the barn, and I was just finishing making the dinner. And so I had, on the range, I was making the gravy, stirring the gravy. And Flora came down, she said, oh, she said, Lewis has got terrible trouble pulling off a lamb. So this ewe was having a double.
Yeah.
Okay, so she was having twins.
Yeah.
But the presentation was wrong. Right. So they were coming out. It was coming out with the tail and the back foot. So you had to basically pop it back in and try and get it back out. But you got a time to get it done, you can imagine.
Yeah, yeah.
And so I pushed the gravy to one side and I washed it. I went up there.
Yeah.
Sat down next to Lewis and said to Lewis, you know, basically, well, this is like a, he said, like, Mum, he said, it's not right. Well, I don't know what to do. And I said, well, think on it as a jigsaw puzzle. Don't think on it being icky or horrid, what's going on. But, you know what belongs to each lamb. Anyway, so I got one off, pulled it off, and I gave it, you have to swing him quite rigorously. You put a little bit,
yeah,
and they put a little bit of straw up its nose to make it sneeze. So then it gets rid of all the yuppiness in the all the airways, and you swing it vigorously and then pat it really hard on its heart area to get it to revive.
Right.
And then with one big cough and sneeze, and then it's alive, and then you just work on it, basically bring it round to the front of the mummy where she's bleating to it.
Yeah.
And to lick it, you know, she knows it's her baby. And so Lewis at this time was retrieving the other one inside her,
yeah,
got that one out. And so I gave that one to Flora and I said, I'm going to go down and finish the dinner now. So she came down, she washed her hands and she sat down for dinner. She was like, I can't believe you've just done that. And you just come back and carried on with the dinner. But that's what women do.
Yes, this is the
start. Men wouldn't be cooking the dinner.
This is the start. Okay. This is how I'm going to start it. You're at the Arca, you're at the range, you're making your gravy.
Yeah.
You pop out, you deliver a sheep, you come back.
Yeah.
What were you carrying on
with the dinner?
What were
lucky
you
doing? The Yorkshires weren't burnt. they would remember that.
That takes multitasking to a whole new level. I've never
seen that. What women can do.
Well, they do. What were you making out of interest? What were you making?
Roast beef. On Sunday.
Just when it went roast lamb.
Yeah. I can't eat lamb. Can't eat lamb. No.
You can't eat it because you know.
No, because a newborn lamb smells like roast lamb.
Oh, no. Really?
Yeah.
Really?
And my husband and I, and Lewis and Ben, when we used to sit down in the beginning, Lewis and Keith used to talk about who we were eating.
No,
I can't eat lamb.
No, I don't blame you. So tell me about your sheep then. I'd love to hear it. How many have you got in your flock?
Oh, now we've got 60 now in our great place flock.
Yeah.
Lewis farms over 700 now.
Wow, so that's
big. But we've still got all our girls, and I know all the generations of bloodlines down.
Do you?
So, for example, our Twiglet was one of our first ewes ever born here. She, a couple of years later, she had a daughter, and she was called Blossom.
Yeah.
So Blossom is therefore had a daughter who's called Petal, And then this year, Blossom had double ewe lambs as well. So we basically keep all the ewe lambs because it's replacement flock, and it's a thing called a closed flock. So you don't buy in it's your own bloodline.
Oh, okay. So you're not diluting the bloodline, as it were.
That's right. And so when you have a ram, when you buy a ram in, so you have to buy a ram in because you can't breed your own ram to go back on your regime. So when you buy a ram in, which we share Lewis's ram from his flock.
Okay.
You can have that ram you can use for 2 years, but on the third year, so basically you lamb in February.
Yeah.
Okay. So let's say Blossom has Petal in February.
Yeah.
So the following February, we wouldn't lamb Petal because she's too young. A lot of farmers do. We don't think they're old enough.
Okay.
So we wait for the following February.
How old are they then? What's the optimum time?
So that would be 2 years old.
Okay.
And then they go from a lamb to what they call a shearling. It's quite complicated.
I know, I've been confusing about it, yeah.
So then they go to what they call a shearling. When they have their own lamb, then they're called a breeding ewe.
Okay. And so for you, they go from lamb to shearling, but you don't breed them until they're two.
Yeah, until they're 18 months, 2 years old, so they're a proper shearling.
Okay. So that's, okay. And you do that because it's kind of to wait.
I think it's like anything. Again, you're saying about what a woman finds different, okay? To me, I don't think that sheep's body has grown enough to accommodate having a lamb.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, now, a lot of farmers, men farmers, would actually think, oh, get on me, put it on. But it's not fair on the ewe.
Yeah,
sheep,
well, they just want to maximise their income, aren't they?
Their yield.
Scaled,
whereas I don't, so I've got a better, but then... You have a better success rate.
Of course, because they're ready to start lambing.
Exactly. And when they first have a shearling has a lamb first time, they basically have them and they do the same thing like, oh my God, where's that come from? You know, that type of thing. So imagine doing that to a ewe lamb, you know, like 12 months old. That's my personal feeling on it.
You are more humane as a farmer, by the sounds of it, than you would be if you were, you know, operating a massive...
Yeah, so for example, we've got this thing going on at home. So Lewis, as you can imagine, has got a massive flock.
Yeah.
If they haven't lambed, you know, they get culled or they go on to something else, which is fair enough. That's the way it works. So when it comes to... We go through at the end of the summer, go through all of my ewes to know whether they're going to go back onto the ram or whether they retire. So I've got the biggest retirement flock going because really they should all go to cull, but I can't do that. I just said to Lewis, so that's not fair. You wouldn't do that to a woman. But the laugh is I've got a ewe called Rose. Okay, so Rose, every time she goes through the race. So what happens is that you collect them all up and there's a thing called a race. So it's like a funnel. You funnel them through. And then they get to the end, and then when they're at the end, before you decide whether they're going to the ram, you first of all check their teeth, because if a ewe hasn't got good teeth and she becomes what they call broken mouthed, so therefore she won't be able to eat enough to be able to have more lamb, you know, to be able to nurture a lamb. She needs to eat for the lamb to grow, etc.
Okay.
So you check their teeth, you check their udders.
Yeah.
To make sure they got like two sides working properly, because if you have a ewe that has a double, i.e. twins, she's going to need two sides.
Yeah.
So you check all of these things with the sheep, make sure she's all right. And then at the end of the race, you open a gate and the gate either goes to ewes that are going to go on to the ram.
Yeah.
So you're getting them all looked after. And there's another gate that basically... In Lewis's bit, it'd be cull, whereas in mine, it's like, oh, you're going into that paddock to be looked after forever.
Are you telling me you've got a retirement home for sheep?
I don't cull any of my sheep.
Oh.
Any of my sheep. I can't do it to them. No, I can't. They've given me lambs. How can you do that to them?
You're like, it's paradise lost for sheep at your house, isn't it? They're not, you know, they're going to get looked after. They can get long tooth. They've got their old crusty udders.
We've got Beryl, who's been walking around here for years and years and years, blind as a bat, loving life. Oh, my My husband says she's a pain in the ass because she gets into everywhere. She can't see where she's going, but she's fine.
She's fine.
So we put Rose through the every year. Rose is empty. So what we class as empty? She's never in lamb. She's always empty every year. So when Rose comes up the race, Lewis always looks down. He said, and he goes, "All right, yeah, we're going to try another year." And he opens up. I said, "Well, give her a chance. She's got him another year." I said, "You know, she just might catch this year."
Oh, you never give up on them, do you? So Rose. Oh, bless her. So is Rose infertile then?
Well, no, Rose actually had a lamb this year.
Oh, she did. So you were right. You didn't get
it. Yeah, she had a lamb this year, yeah.
So you're applying a lot of human, I suppose, emotions and feelings towards these animals, which I suppose might be looked down on by some, but actually, in some ways, I can see that what you're doing does pay off because you're investing in these sheep and you're in it for the long term, I suppose, with them.
Yeah, and I think most probably mine is more, I'm a woman, I'm maternal, so,
yeah.
You know, it's like, you know, there's lots of other really, I mean, like the original shepherdess, the lady up in the fells up there, her photographs are amazing. At the time I dropped my phone, you know, you're lucky if you find it to take a photograph. And then that Yorkshire shepherdess, the one with the, like, loads of children.
Oh, yes, yeah, she was the one that started it already, didn't she?
Yeah, so you've got all of that going on, that and diff, but there are other women like me who have small flocks around,
yeah.
You know, who just enjoy on the wool side of things as well.
Yeah, which is, this is what's lovely about you. You're spinning off into another, literally spinning off into another direction. You're continuing heritage, crafts and arts, and it's a complete sustainability, isn't it? You've got a full circle there going, haven't you? Which obviously the Yorkshire Shepherdess, her scale is too big, I'm assuming, to do that.
Yeah. Yeah,
but what I love is that you're using the knitting patterns and the crochet patterns from the women in your family, and you're bringing the sheep that the women in your family sheep. So there's such a lovely circularity to all of it.
Yeah,
I mean it must be incredibly rewarding for you to do.
I think it is, and today I had an email from Sidmouth WI. So last year I went, or year before because of it being COVID, I went to a guest speak there. I went in, got ready and everything. My husband was outside. He said he couldn't believe it. He said they were queuing up to come and listen to me speak. And we counted, like, and there was like 140 people there.
Oh, wow.
And, you know, and they were like back to back. They'd come in to hear me speak. You know, that I can remember saying, oh, my God, no pressure here. But I think... Because
you're a wonderful speaker, though, because you're such a natural, and you don't rehearse, you just speak from the heart, and you're talking passionate about.
And it was just, I tell the story of my Granny Vaughan, but then I always say about Primrose, what a girl she was, you know, and I explain, you know, like she's just so funny. That's another story of it all.
Oh, tell me about Primrose. I'd love to hear about Primrose.
So Primrose, when Primrose was young, we can't at the moment, this year or last year. So the last show of the season is Widdicombe Fair, okay? Up on the moors. It's always the last show in season. So we show our sheep when we can, okay? So up there, it's a proper, it's last show. You see everyone you know, all the farming people get together. It's real lovely, just really, really lovely thing to do. So on the way back, the ram that we take to show, we always rattle him up on the way back. And it's always known to us, so the ram goes in with the ewe on Widdicombe Fair Day. So that's his first day of tupping. So tupping is when a ram goes with the ewe, you know, to mate.
Okay, yeah.
So we always put a paste on him. We get into the field, and Lewis at the time would have had a Land Rover and trailer. Open the gate, all the ewes are in there. Now, previous to that, they would have had what they call a teaser ram go in. So basically, a teaser ram is a boy ram that's had his bits and pieces sorted out.
Yeah.
So he thinks he can do it, but he can't do it.
Oh.
So he just takes them. So the ram's in there to make them feel in the mood for love.
Right.
But he can't do anything, okay?
So what's his goal there? Like, why is he...
To get them ovulating. So get them all ovulating together. So when we put the big ram in, the ram then go round and basically tap them all in the first ovulation period. So then...
Is the warm-up act, really, is he?
Yeah, so he is. He's like any man. He thinks he can do the job, but when it comes down to it, he definitely can.
So that's around.
I always say that, and it gets all the ladies laughing.
Oh, but they love it.
Yeah, so basically what happens is, so we come back from Widdicombe Fair, we go into the field, the ram's got all his rattle on between his front legs, so when he jumps onto the ewe, you see all these sheep with different coloured bottoms?
Yeah.
You know, like in September time? That isn't because the farmer's painted them, it's because the ram has gone on and mated them, so the colour, so basically, you know what I was saying about ovulation?
Yeah.
You want them to ovulate all together, so because you don't want to be lambing forever.
No, you want it all to happen in February or May.
Yeah.
Probably, yeah?
So one thing that what people don't realise is sheep aren't stupid. So when that ram has mated with that ewe, mm-hmm. and she's pregnant, he will know she's pregnant and he won't go back and mate her again.
Really? How does he know that? Smell or?
But wouldn't that be good in life if that happened with women? that's what I always say as well, and of course the women are less like, oh yeah. So they know. Isn't that amazing?
That's incredible. Sheep are very clever then, actually. I always have an image of sheep being a bit very sweet.
Yeah, no. So basically, so we go back to Widdicombe Fair, the trailer's gone on the field, Lewis has got out, he's taken the top of the back of the trailer down, the ram stood there looking glorious, stood there, and he's sniffing the air like they do, and their little nose goes up and their mouth opens, and all the girls are turning around like, whoa, who's that?
Yeah.
Now, Primrose is always one of those girls, but she's passed away. We lost her and Mabel 18 months ago, I was devastated. But Primrose, she was such a good time girl. By the time we got the trailer out of it and locked the door, we leaned back over the gate, she would have been mated.
No.
Yeah. Yeah, Primrose loved life.
Oh, she was good at it.
Another little story with Primrose. When a few years ago, we've got the grey-faced Dartmoor sheep and we've got blue-faced Leicester sheep.
Yeah.
So blue-faced Leicester are really the ugliest sheep in the whole wide world, but they give you beautiful soft wool.
Okay.
So we at that time had a ram called Pete. So Pete was my best friend Sarah's husband. And Sarah said, she came from supper. On a Thursday night, it was always chippy night, and they come over and pick the chips up. And she got there one day and this ram had just arrived. And she's like, oh my God, look how ugly he is. And so one night, Lewis brought Pete back and he said, I'm going to take him with the blue face flock, but I've just left him outside the girls' paddock. So I had all the retired girls at the front. So that was Beryl, Primrose, Mabel out at the front. And then he said, I put Pete next door because he's all rattled up, ready to go with the girls. And at the time, I said, oh, I don't think that's a good idea that you've done that. He said, what do you mean? They're all old and they're tough, you know, you ain't gonna get in with them and then not with him. I doubt they're ovulating. So in the morning, I opened the blind up and I looked out the front. There were no girls there, no girls at all. And I looked to the right of the field, and there was a primrose-sized hole in the hedge. So no. Primrose had gone into with Pete.
Oh,
and Pete. And she'd got in with Pete, and so Beryl couldn't see a thing. So I can just imagine this is what happened in the night. I think Primrose must have got, sniffed the air and thought, oh, what's that? I can come on with me, girls, follow me. Gone through the hedge, squeezed through the hedge. She was found in the corner. She had got Pete in the corner. She was rattled all over, Primrose was, from Pete.
Oh, my God.
We had to put Pete in the stable for a week. It's like he'd been...
Recover.
And Beryl and Mabel were also marked by him. So I think what happened, she must have said, like, come on, girls, let's go down here. I can smell a nice young Beryl and Bachat. And got down there. And I can imagine Beryl and Primrose saying, oh, where have you gone to, Primrose? And Beryl was like, oh, what was that? And Mabel's gone, oh, I don't know. It's happened to me as well. So, yeah, that year we had what they call cross sheep. They're called mules when you cross the sheep.
Oh, so they did have babies?
They had babies.
But they had babies. They were ovulating then. They were dried up, as it were.
Yeah, no, exactly. Yeah, exactly. Don't rule an old woman out. It's called experience.
I feel like there are so many parallels between your farm. And your farm is like a microcosm of life, isn't it? You know, don't a girl out. There's so many little lessons and fables that we can learn from these sheep. She was incredibly game. But you've lost these girls, have you? Primrose and Beryl.
No, I've got Beryl here. Beryl's still here. Mabel and Primrose have gone.
Oh.
But they've got their generations of girls, you know, their bloodline going down through.
They do have their own strong characters, don't they, these sheep? They are like, you know, like, they are different, are they? Is that, and you obviously naming them, I suppose you can do that when you've got a smaller flock, because...
Yeah, when you've got a small flock.
They've got a
strong... And I think, I mean, like my husband, him and Lewis is quite good, he knows, I'll refer to him like Blossom, and whenever, because Blossom, she didn't, for the first 2 years, she didn't have lambs, and they either absorb, so she got pregnant, and sometimes you can absorb a lamb inside.
Oh,
so
really?
They are pregnant, but nothing happens, or they can have one early, a bit like ladies, really.
Have a miscarriage, really.
Yeah, so when she had her first lambs, it's like she was waiting for me to help her give birth, and she was bleating for me, and I cried. It was so lovely. But I know them all, but my husband's like, how on earth do you know that one come from that one and that one? But you just
do. Just instinct, feminine intuition.
Yeah, and I think, again, I remember quite a lot of things.
Yeah, and I think, but you're proving to me, just in the stories that you're telling me, why women make such good shepherdesses, because you're intuitive as women. I think that we are very instinctive about things, and therefore you're much more aligned with these, because they're sentient beings, aren't they? And therefore you can relate to them on a feminine level.
And I think as well, like 1 year, so I'm in a WI, and 1 year we were up to Cardiff for the AGM. It was about 2-3 years ago, and I was up being picked up from Chudley in a big bus that went the length and breadth of Devon. You can imagine all the little lanes that must have gone through, and all these little deers getting on, and they got their sandwiches out, you know, proper. You could write a story about that. And then I was in the kitchen sink, and I was looking out, and it was this time of the year, so it's what we call maggot time. And you can tell when they got something going on, because they've flicked their tail. So basically the grass is so good.
Yeah.
Okay. They've been shorn, but the grass is so good, so they get, you know, a bit like the shits, really, to be honest.
Oh, okay.
And then the blowfly will land on that. Within 24-hour period, maggots can go right through a sheep.
Really?
Awful. So I was at the sink waiting, and I had to go down and catch this bus. And, you know, just had I was finishing off some stuff. The boys were out. They were doing hay that day. And I looked out, and I seen one of the ewes' little tails flicking. I thought, oh, she'll be all right till they get home. I'll leave a message. And it was still coming off flicking. I thought, oh, I'm just going to have to go out and, you know, really put some spray on her, take the maggots out. So I pinned her. I was all ready to go this WI thing. I pinned me, put my dress up in my knickers like you do.
Yeah.
Went out with my wellies on, sorted this out. And I had iodine spray on me from where I'd got these few maggots out. Caught the bus, went down, got on the bus, and the woman who saved me a seat, she's proper Devon. She's all right, mate. She said, we were going to go without you. I said, we'd had a bit of maggots. I had to deal with it. And she said, I thought you had maggots. I said, was it iodine on my hand? She said, no. She said, you've got one little maggot still in your form of your hair. Yeah. So it's been proper Devon on the farm. All the women know what's what.
You are such a born storyteller.
Oh,
you could have your own YouTube channel or something. The way you tell stories, it's like, I can sit and listen to you. But listen, I am mindful. I don't want to tire you out.
No, I'm fine. I just wanted to sort of explain. So, like, when I go guest speaking, which is quite nice, it takes women away from whatever they were doing at home into another little world where they can learn a little bit about the sheep world, but more about the whole area that we live in.
Yeah, and what can sheep teach us, do you think? Because they obviously have such strong, much stronger characters than...
I don't understand, Kate. I don't understand why this country, again, because of the rag trade in the East End, why we have to import wool.
Why do we
export so much? Because, you know, going back to those eras, we used everything.
Yeah, you know, I don't understand that. And where do we import most of our wool from? New Zealand or...
God knows.
But
God knows what goes on now with it all. There are less and less mills in the whole of the UK. The only one in the southwest is in Cornwall.
I think a lot of that...
Nothing in Devon, nothing, not one mill.
But the problem that I can see is that we used to be a country that made and produced goods and services that we exported all around the world. And now I think when we shifted to finance, we were the main sort of, we became a financial country, and we stopped producing and exporting cars and all the rest of it and food. We seem to have, I feel like it's really sad. We demolished a whole industry and you know, a whole wave of kind of apprenticeships that would have risen up.
Yeah, and like the fashion era, isn't it? You know, it's such a, you know, if people want something now, it's so cheap to buy something, and then it all gets put into refuge. And
I think that will change, though. I feel like it has to change, and I think that people like you doing what you're doing is going to lend us more towards that way. So there are kind of two final things I just sort of want to pick up.
Yeah, and then I talk about my Barbara Turner.
Talk about Barbara Turner. Yeah. So with the women like the Yorkshire Shepherdess, who's, I mean, this is obviously really taken off now, is this sort of new women blazing this trail. What do you feel about these women? Are you grateful to them for doing this?
Oh, yeah. I think it's wonderful, really.
Yeah.
But it actually shows that women can do the same job as men, but I don't think they've been given the chance to. Because I think, going back to me, like with my trade, going into accountancy, because I was expected to have children and then go back and do a bit of book work on the side.
Yeah.
But I still do think we still are on that, because again, like, you'll go and do a day's work and your husband will go and do a day's work, but really it's you who puts the dinner on the table still.
Well, women, I always say this, women hold down three jobs, don't we? We've got the day job, then we've got the house, and then we've got the kids. Whereas the majority of men hold down one job, you know.
Yeah.
So we're always working. Yeah. We're in a state of perpetual motion, and I think that's so. And
I think when I had my brain tumor, so I got taken into hospital on my birthday,
which was your 60th, wasn't it? Your 50th. Sorry, what?
I was 53. 50,
sorry, that's right. Yeah.
Don't say I'm bloody 60.
Oh, I was thinking that can't be right, because you're nowhere near 60.
So it's 31st of March.
Yeah.
So we were meeting up with Lewis and Flora, and Keith had had a big cake made, which I didn't know, and myself and Keith, and we were going to the beach. I hadn't been well, and the doctor said, you need to go down to Torbay Hospital, down to A&E, they'll be waiting for you, because there's something wrong. I had been falling over a lot in an 18-month period. I'll show you my arms to show you, like, can you see the marks?
You're really bruised, aren't you?
I just kept bumping into things and falling over, and at lambing time it was really difficult because I started getting vertigo as well. Really bad vertigo. So when you're down doing something and lifting your head up and like, oh, that's really bad.
Doing more spin, yeah.
Yeah, but I didn't think I was ill, but I wasn't right. There were lots of things going on. And so then I got taken into hospital.
Yeah.
They know what they're doing. These doctors know, don't they? And then I got 12 hours later told that I had a grade 1 milli, well, it's, you have to Google it or something, milli, whatever it was, in my cerebella or something.
Cerebella, like, yeah.
Yeah, that.
Ear, isn't it?
Yeah. That's why I've got the hearing aids now. And then told that. But because it was COVID, I was told at the hospital on my own, hideous. And, I was going to have cake with my children on the beach, to be told this 12 hours later on your own.
Oh.
And then they said special circumstances. My husband was allowed to come down, but stand at the beginning of the ward. And I had to talk to him, you know, him all masked up and everything. So, huge shock. And then I had to wait for 3 days while they scanned the rest of my body to make sure there wasn't any more tumours in there. In that time, you know, I told the boys on the phone, fortunate it's benign, so now they're monitoring it, what's going on, but other things are happening to me at the moment. But when I was in hospital, so it gives you time to reflect and think about things. And you know, there's also the other thing, you can't do nothing about it. People know, you know, the doctors, the surgeons, everyone knows what to do. You're in their hands, so you're going to be sad. But really, I spoke to someone whose mother was diagnosed, and he said pretty much the same as me. There seems to be two type of women, or, you know, there's a person who maybe just feels a little bit sad and hasn't got the momentum or the motivation to sort of like grasp it by the horns and think, well, actually, I'm not going anywhere. You're going somewhere.
Yeah.
And he said his mother, which is the same as me, really, she does so much, if not too much, that you get a burnout because you don't want it to affect you, if that makes sense.
Yes, yeah. And which is, and how are you feeling about it then? Where, what camp would you say that you're in? Like,
well, I had a month, so I had the first month, so we were waiting for hospital appointments and all this, that and the other, really knowing what's going on so much medication. So you're just so tired from medication and so many steroids that, you know, my husband just called me Peppa Pig. Just like, and I was like a hamster. And then the second month, because we closed the website down, and then second week in May, I put it back up again because I needed to be busy. I just needed to be really busy with things. You know what's going on. You know inevitably you've got something in your head that at some stage is going to be dealt with.
Yeah.
But in the meantime, I think if you can keep a good mental strength.
Yeah.
I don't drink alcohol anyway or smoke, but yeah. I am as healthy lifestyle. I think what you put in is what you get out.
I agree.
You know, so yeah. I've always cooked everything from scratch. We've always done all of that anyway. We've got our own eggs, you know, everything. We try and be self-sufficient. I just thought, right, okay, this is a time, again, when I left my accountancy job, I was at another crossroads. How am I going to address this crossroads? Okay, so this is the things I need to do. And when I came out of hospital, I was so worried that I wouldn't be able to read properly, because when I was reading, I had your book in hospital. I told you that woman dropped that water on it and I was going to brain her. And I was reading, but nothing was going in. I couldn't digest. So what I did each day is I made sure, and I still do it now, every day when I wake up, I get a cup of tea, go back to bed, and I read 25 pages of a book.
25 pages. Okay.
Every single day. Every single day.
To keep the muscle memory strong, you mean? Like,
yeah, and to read properly, you know, to digest that 25 pages, not just like ghost reading it, but really read it properly. So some days I would read 50 or more, you know, sit down in the day. But so I would start my routine off, okay, because in the morning you're not tired, you know, your brain isn't tired. So I feel you wake up, and that was good for my brain. I also made sure, because I found my left side didn't feel as strong as my right side. So I tried in the morning to do as much, especially in this first month, as much with my left hand as I could.
Yeah.
I think it's recognising your own body and how it's affecting.
Yeah. So you have an extraordinary mental resilience. And the way that you're tackling this, to me, you're being very strategic about it and you're doing all the right things. That's something that obviously comes naturally to you. I can see that strength. Mm. That's the way you're tackling it. You've named it. Why have you named it? Is that because
because I think it's horrible. Like my boys to be, you know, like, and Ben's a teacher. So he went to the school staff room. And so they go around in the staff room at the end of Easter. And basically it was like, what you've been doing, you know, a bit like a stimulation thing, like they do like bridging, don't they, like staff building. Oh, we've been doing this, that and the other. And they got to Ben and they said, so what have you been doing? He said, well, I've had a pretty bad one really. And oh, well, what's happened? He said, well, my mum was taken into hospital and the head was like, oh gosh, is she all right? He said, well, no, not really, she's got a brain tumor. He said, but we don't call it a brain tumor, we call it a Barbara Turner. The reason I called it that, because I thought at the time it was very hard for my family to, you know, it's brain tumor sounds so hideous, doesn't it?
Yeah.
And so, and being the way I was, you know, with trying to not be rude about it, but maybe accept it. So it's like, and it's a bit funny really, because I always say to my husband, I said, oh, what's it like going to bed with two women, you know? Do you know what I mean? It's just trying to make fun of it, you know.
You have to humanize things, don't you?
Yes.
The way that you name your sheep and the way that you relate to stories, you are a person that thrives off stories.
Mm.
And we see that with your brain tumor, by giving it a name and identity, you've turned it into a story, and therefore you're owning it because it's your story to tell. Does that make sense? That's how I feel like when you're talking about it.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, it is true. And I just think as well, if I can, then when I go guest speaking, if I can sort of like just maybe someone else has gone down that route, or maybe they know someone who's going down that route. And if I say, well, I just read, make sure, you know, I read 25 pages a day because I feel it's good for me, because I could think of nothing worse than not being able to read ever again. I just like, oh
yeah. Well, it's the stuff of life, isn't it? What would we do?
Exactly.
Reading and stories, it's escape, isn't it?
And it's everyone. And so I would feel if any woman out there who enjoys doing some, it's like gardening's really bad because I can't put my head down. Because I've got bad vertigo. So there's lots of things you can and can't do. Know your limitations. Don't get burnout.
Yeah.
But really, I think be quite self-assertive about where you're going and about what you're doing, and not tiring yourself out, planning. I mean, I've had a really busy week this week, but planning things forward.
Yeah.
Yeah, I suppose it's just the way I am, really.
I think it's managing your life now, isn't it? What are you doing with the business side of things then, Paula?
Oh, I'm busier than ever.
Really? So do all come in via the website, do they? How does it work?
Yeah, they all come in via the website, which I've got a global, you know, I've got two ladies who work for me.
Okay.
So, and they've always worked with me, two retired ladies. One's really good on crochet, one's really good on knitting. So I generally think of the idea in the beginning, and then it's given to who, you know, who's best suited for the job. But the thing being with it, so yesterday I went to my photographer for all the new things to go online now, but I've been working on them for the last 6 months.
Okay, and what are the most popular things? Because you've got some beautiful stuff on there.
Little
radishes, the radish brooches. But what do people, what's the most sought after items on your website?
Well, I think about the poppies. Well, back in 2014, we were on country file for our poppies.
Oh, right. Okay.
So I was the first poppy maker. My granddad, he was prisoner of war. So that's another story. And so he was he was prisoner of war, got shot down a Lancaster bomber. I'll have to tell you that story. You would love it. Oh. And he always said, always remember and never forget. And so when he passed away, I started making poppies. I made one in the beginning and it started and it exploded, honestly.
It's not a paper disposable poppy that you throw away.
Exactly. And it's made with Dartmoor wool. If it goes in a washing machine, comes out, it felt, so you just spread it out. But my hats, I'm busy with hats, but everything really, there isn't anything. Our little brooches, I try and keep on the bin. They will look something like from the 40s, like that would have been worn then, because I love that era. I should have been in that era.
Same. I love the fashion from it. I should have been born
So do I.
Honestly, sometimes I just think, why was I born in 1974? I should have been born in, you know, 1924, and then I could have been.
Oh, definitely.
And I would have loved 40s fashion, hair, makeup.
And when I hear about my gran going up to the dances and everything, God.
I'd have been climbing down the drain pipe with Betty. I'd have been 100% there.
Yeah.
Love it.
All of those things and what they did in that era, it's so magical. I love it.
You know what? This is a little aside, and I think you'd absolutely love it. And if you haven't read it, I'm going to post it to you. I ghost wrote the memoirs of a lady called Molly Moran. And she was a scullery maid in service between the wars. It was the height of the Downton Abbey fever. And when I interviewed her, she was 100. Amazing lady, Molly, such character, born in Norfolk. And she was in service as a scullery maid for the gentry in Norfolk. And she was the biggest character of all. She was always copping off with the chauffeur because she had a nice tight bum. And she was always sneaking out under the butler's nose and climbing down the drain pipe to go to the dances. And she was so talented. She could make anything. She was an incredible cook. And I wrote her book for Penguin. It was called Aprons and Silver Spoons. And it did really well. And she was on This Morning and everybody loved her. She was such a great character. But you remind me of her quite a lot. Full of life, full of fun and mischief.
I really hope that you enjoyed that conversation. If you have any questions or comments about any of the topics raised in our conversation, or perhaps you have a story you'd like to share, then do get in touch via my website, Facebook or Instagram, details of which are all listed on the podcast. Thanks for listening.